Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Voice of Tangaroa is a collaboration between New Zealand Geographic and RNZ. Reporting for this series is public interest journalism funded through New Zealand On Air.
It's just such an exquisite place. It's so vast and so untouched.
You couldn't invent a better carbon burial system.
Oh, look, going through. Can you see them?
Can you see the inanga?
Oh, wait, they're just,
Yeah.
Going back out.
You know, we talk about New Zealand being New Zealand clean and green. That's the vision I would like to see. A New Zealand that's authentically clean and green.
Kia ora anō, nau mai, welcome back to Voice of Tangaroa. Ko Clare Kananaho, producer and presenter of Our Changing World on RNZ.
Ko Kate Evans tēnei, freelance science journalist. For the last 2 years, I've been writing features for New Zealand Geographic about our oceans. And across that time, this has happened.
2022 was a year of extremes and our hottest on record.
Humanity has been given a final warning to act swiftly on climate change.
In the oceans, hotter and more frequent marine heat waves are likely, with marine heat wave conditions possibly becoming permanent by the end of the century.
This isn't going to be a doom and gloom episode where you tell us how terrible everything is in the oceans because of climate change, is it?
Surprisingly, no. Actually, today I've got two stories of hopefulness, and both are centred around blue carbon.
What's blue carbon?
Well, to avert the worst of the climate crisis, we need to reduce our emissions. Phasing out fossil fuels is one sure way to cut down on carbon dioxide, one of the main greenhouse gases. This means we stop taking forms of carbon like oil and gas out of the ground. Instead, we leave it there, locked up. But there are other places too where carbon gets safely tucked away out of the atmosphere for decades, even centuries. Long-lived trees, for instance, and some soils. And recently, there's been a lot of talk about blue carbon, the ways in which some ocean ecosystems also lock up carbon long-term. So I wanted to investigate what role New Zealand's huge ocean domain and our extensive coastline might play. Which brought photographer Richie Robinson and me to this place.
So we've just stepped on board the Polaris in Deep Cove in Doubtful Sound, and it's been pouring all night. And the waterfalls, like this whole bay is just waterfalls. It's stunning.
The Polaris is the University of Otago's scientific research vessel. And all day, the team has been busy collecting mud and water.
Yeah, that'll work. Mud. Soft mud, yeah.
Good consistency.
Yeah, good consistency. The core should have no problem going.
It looks like a cow pat.
They sound pretty excited about some mud. And what do you mean it looks like a cow pat?
Well, it's kind of this dark, globby texture. And yeah, when I first saw it, that's what it reminded me of. But some of the other mud from a bit deeper down is even blacker and silkier. And I decided it actually looked quite delicious. Think like dark chocolate ganache. The cow pat stuff came from a test run they do before they grab the actual sediment samples. That's done with a piece of equipment called a multicorer, which looks like a moon lander with some plastic tubes on the bottom to collect the samples.
Basically what they're doing is they're very softly taking the absolute top layer.
Adele Heineman is one of the crew on board, one of the skippers. We're watching as the multicorer is being prepared. It's a relatively new, very expensive piece of tech for the team.
Last year was its maiden voyage and there was a lot of issues with it not deploying. This year they'd had 100% success rate until you guys come on board.
Whoops, sorry about that.
I had only done about 4 or 5, you know, we're talking relative.
Classic. It was all working just fine until the journalist and photographer showed up.
Yeah. Well, it's a 3-week expedition and they'll be dropping the multicorer a dozen times in 4 different fjords, so they'll have a few more chances.
Slow down a bit, Adele.
Next time it gets winched back
right
up. Everything has gone to plan.
All there.
And I want to explain more about this mud. But first, maybe I should give some more context.
Blue carbon basically refers to the process where carbon is drawn down from the atmosphere and taken into the marine environment.
This is Dr. Rebecca McLeod, a marine ecologist based at the University of Otago and the chair of the Fiordland Marine Guardians. I caught up with her first at the holiday park in Tiano the evening before we headed into Fiordland together.
The process of capturing the carbon dioxide in the first place is done by the plants, whether those are like seagrass or mangroves or seaweeds or like phytoplankton, little microalgae. That's kind of the process of capturing that carbon. But then when it sinks and is buried in the seafloor, that's when it's locked away forever. Well, we hope, all for long time scales.
So fjords are not the only candidate when we think about how good marine environments are at storing carbon. There's also wetlands, mangrove forests, seagrass meadows and estuaries, even seaweed if it can get buried before it decays. But fjords do seem to be the champs.
They're so supercharged that they just really punch above their weight when it comes to carbon burial.
And even in this category of champs, Fiordland's fjords are a cut above the rest.
We took some scientists in that work in fjords all around the world just a couple of months ago, and I haven't visited many other fjords around the world, so I just figured, you know, maybe Patagonia, maybe Scotland, that'll kind of be like our fjords. But these guys, their minds were just blowing in front of us, and they were just like, if you were going to design a system that to bury carbon, it would look like Fiordland.
Hell yeah, go Fiordland. How good is it, and what makes it so good?
Well, exactly how good Fiordland is at storing carbon is one of the key questions that Rebecca and the team are trying to answer. From atmospheric observations, there's an estimate that between 10 and 20% of New Zealand's carbon emissions are being captured by Fiordland's forests and fjords each year.
That's a pretty hefty chunk.
Yeah, especially since it's such a small part of our coastline. As to what makes it so good, it's a combination of things. And I was lucky enough to experience one of the main contributing factors.
It's still raining. It's been raining for 2 days straight, I think.
Associate Professor Chris Moy is the expedition lead and an earth scientist at the University of Otago. It's right on dusk, and we're standing on the deck of the Polaris in Hall Arm, off Doubtful Sound, looking around at the sodden scene before us.
It's breathtaking, right? The parts that you can see on the margin, the hillside here is just covered with water. Like every kind of bare area essentially has water running down it.
Yeah, and the kind of amazing thing about it is that like that it does directly play into your research as well, because you can see, you know that carbon is coming down with that water, right?
Indeed, yeah. So you know that it's bringing soil, it's bringing plant material. If it really is like a strong storm or a strong rainfall event where there's a high amount of precipitation in a short period of time, then we could even get trees coming in, you know, so so it definitely scales.
Between 6 and 10 metres of rain falls in Fiordland each year, maybe even more in some spots.
So we have the rainfall, and that's driving this temperate rainforest that we see here. And then on top of that, we have, you know, the geology, the tectonics, and we have a large strike slip fault that's coming into Milford Sound, or just to the north and west of Milford Sound, the Alpine Fault. And so we have this element of shaking that's kind of shaking all this carbon.
That's good for carbon storage, is it?
Yeah, that's one component. But, you know, we were going through, as we were driving into Hall Arm, and we can see some of these evidence of past slips. And what's really remarkable to me is that kind of the regeneration of vegetation is really quick. And so that's part of the Fiordland carbon story. That's quite unique that you get, you know, these events, either an extreme climate event, like a big rainfall event that washes away, and that brings all this organic material into the fjord. Or we have these earthquakes that dislodge material and send it all in. And so these are ways to really quickly advect this carbon into the fjords. And then we also have these suboxic kind of fjord basins that are working to try to preserve a lot of that carbon.
Okay, so it's the combo of heavy rainfall that allows trees to thrive and grow, then landslides and earthquakes that shakes material loose from steep hills, so it falls into the fjords and sinks, and then it's back to the rain, which allows fast regeneration of the forest, pulling in more carbon.
That's it.
But what's the last thing he said? Suboxic fjord basins. What are those?
Well, microbes like bacteria love to eat plant material. When they break it down, they release the carbon back into the atmosphere. But they need oxygen to do this. And in the fjords, the oxygen concentration on the seafloor varies. Chris is particularly excited about the suboxic and anoxic basins, places with little to no oxygen. Generally, these are the deep troughs close to the heads of the fjords, the land end. Away from the sea, not much circulation happens, and so they're low on oxygen.
Some that are quite restricted and don't get kind of fresh Tasman seawater for a long period of time. They kind of have like stinky old water in them, I've heard people refer to it. And then others that are refresh quite frequently.
But the stinky old water is quite good for preserving the carbon.
Indeed. Mm. Yeah, indeed it is. And certainly the mud that you pull out of that, it looks really unique when you sample these basins. It looks really, really black. It's got lots of organic material. So organic material even that you can recognize, like leaves from the surrounding forest, sticks, branches, all types of debris essentially derived from land and it's being sequestered in these basins.
Like the stuff we saw today, do you mean?
Indeed. Yeah. So some good examples from Deep Cove and then here in Hall Arm as well.
I found it really satisfying to look at. Like I should have run, I wanted to run my fingers through it.
You didn't
like,
do that.
I should.
We have to do that before
it looks
we...
It like so silky and so
tomorrow
black
morning,
and
indeed.
Like...
Mm. You can get some areas that are, when you get closer to the rivers, that might have a little bit more sand and grit in it. Mm-hmm. But the ones that are deeper and farther from the margins of the fjord are super silky and smooth.
So back to the mud chat, hey.
It's what this expedition's all about. Some of what they collect smells too, that typical Rotorua smell. It's because the anoxic mud is home to a different sort of bacteria that thrive without oxygen and don't release the carbon, but instead produce sulfur. The samples they're collecting will allow them to make a carbon sequestration map of the fjords. Here's Rebecca again.
Are there some fjords or some parts of the fjords that bury carbon faster than others? Like are that right up in the heads of the fjords? Is that more important than out at the entrance? How much carbon are they burying in the fjords that comes from the forest versus stuff that is generated in the marine environment, like seaweeds and microalgae and things like that?
They also take longer, deeper cores to enable them to look back in time.
You can analyse back down through that sediment core and start to reconstruct like what the ocean conditions have been like.
The goal is to understand what might happen as our climate changes. Will it impact circulation in the fjords, affect the anoxic conditions and disrupt carbon burial, perhaps even releasing tons of it into the atmosphere? Are there other human activities that could turn the fjords from a carbon sink to a source? So far, one of the great things about Fiordland is that it's been left relatively untouched. It was established as a national park in 1952, and then protection in the sea followed, mainly thanks to the Fiordland Marine Guardians, a collection of fishers, tourism operators, locals, and Rebecca herself.
That group established 10 marine reserves throughout the Fiordland Marine Area and did some really innovative stuff with fisheries management in there and a few other bits and pieces to protect important parts of the seafloor. And again, that was really visionary stuff and quite ahead of its time. But when you combine the marine protection with the national park protection and you get this full sort of holistic system that has really high levels of protection, they wouldn't have even thought about the mud at that point. And they collectively, those pieces of work have managed to save this amazing natural asset that is helping our world.
It's like it's been doing all this invisible labour for us all along.
Yeah.
We just didn't notice.
No, we just were floating around and going, oh, look at the beautiful mountains.
Thank you, Fiordland Mud, for your services to carbon burial. And how good that those predictions were there. Because that's not been the case for some of those other blue carbon candidates you mentioned. Like for some of our coastal environments, estuaries, salt marshes and seagrass meadows. They've taken a hit.
Yeah, in New Zealand, we've lost 90% of our wetlands, including the salty ones. And you might think rainforests like the Amazon are good at sucking in carbon, but internationally, wetlands have been shown to do the job up to 55 times faster, holding 4 times as much carbon in their soils, though it depends on the specific place and the type of plants growing there. In Aotearoa, clearing land for development, farming and forestry has sent topsoil flowing into estuaries. Up north, mangroves have been a winner from this increased sedimentation, growing in their coverage by about 4% per year. But in other places, the sediments clog up and kill off nana, seagrass meadows.
Oh yeah, and seagrass also buries carbon in the sand amongst its roots. I know researchers in the Cawthron Institute in Nelson are working on this. they're collecting seeds from the tiny seagrass flowers to grow them in the lab to help restore the struggling meadows in Nelson's Haven.
And Nelson isn't the only place where there's been a loss of seagrass. While we're just figuring out the fjords, we know a little bit more about how these shallow ecosystems take up carbon, at least overseas. And restoring them is one of the best ways we know to suck extra carbon out of the atmosphere.
Once upon a time, Waihi Estuary, like many estuaries around the country, was known for its abundance of plentiful food that required little to no effort to harvest. So you would have fat, healthy, clean pipi shells.
Professor Kura Paul Burke is a marine scientist at the University of Waikato.
Kia ora, ko Ngāti Pakihi mō rāua, ko Ngāti Awa ngā iwi, ko Pukuhina rāua, ko Rewatū ngā marae. Ko Kura Paul Burke tōku ingoa. Kia ora, I'm Kura and this is the land of my ancestors. So right now we're walking down a dirt track at this place is called Te Heri Heri, its original name, and it is the seasonal settlement of our iwi. This is where my dad, my ancestors would come back in the day. They would settle here over summer to collect kai, food from the wetlands, from the estuary and the rivers, which they would then take back to their respective houses to store for the winter.
But that's all changed.
Now we have, you know, consistent public health warnings, shellfish toxicity warnings, a plethora of bad news for Waihi Estuary, not only in terms of pollutants coming into our estuary, but degrading and declining quality and quantities of kaimoana.
What caused that?
It's the cumulative effect of half a century of drainage, river straightening, forestry runoff, and a whole lot more cows and kiwi fruit.
Did you know it's one of the top five most degraded in the country?
Wow.
So sad.
Yeah.
And not getting better.
How does that feel for you?
Oh, well, I could cry. But, you know, like kaitiakitanga or, you know, active guardianship isn't about, we can sit on the couch and we can lament and we can point fingers and we can cry and that's going to achieve nothing at all. So we're all about action. Kaitiakitanga denotes action. So it's all about pragmatic, active restoration of our estuary, our wetland and our wider catchment. Healthy estuary, healthy people.
It's the opposite kind of a day to my time in Fiordland. It's sunny and warm, a little bit windy, and I've tagged along with a group of 10 students visiting the estuary as Te Taru White welcomes us with a karakia.
Haumie, huie,
taiki.
Kia ora tātou. It's my privilege to be here as the chair of Te Wahupu o Waihi, an interesting partnership between the iwi of this particular whenua, of this particular iwi area, and the Bay of Plenty Regional Council. I wear a tag on my jumper that says Bay of Plenty Regional Council, but like all of you, we're our people in our heart. And that makes the difference to this particular program. It's that heart that we're leading with. It's the fact that we're taking the lead in this, not the council, not the system. We are, and that includes all of you, our tauira, who have been here with us.
The catchment's five iwi, Ngāti Whakahemo, Ngāti Whakaawe ki Makatū, Ngāti Mākino, Ngāti Pikiao and Tapuika are all involved in the collective Te Wahapu o Waihi, of which Kura is the project lead. Like Te Taru, the rangatahi all whakapapa to this place.
I have been brought up in this particular space harvesting kaimoana as a baby boomer. You know, one of these dinosaurs who's a child. We're harvesting with our communities and our whānau and our people, getting the pipis, the kaimoana, the tuangis, you know, all those sorts of things. Camping here and being able to gather that and live as a community and share that kai. No longer can we do that. That is a travesty.
We walk along a stop bank on the edge of the Pongakawa River. From here, we're looking down into a flat expanse of empty farmland. It was once a repo, a salt marsh wetland. And there would be a super easy way to restore it back to wetland if you could ignore economic considerations.
Does anyone know what that little building is down there?
Pim Demonchi is Coastal Catchments Manager for the Bay of Plenty Regional Council.
In this catchment, there are 13 pump stations that have been operating since about the 1950s. And what they do is they take the groundwater and they lower it by maybe half a metre. What that does is it pulls the groundwater below the root zone of the grasses and allows the grasses to grow, which is excellent for farming because then you can farm the land. But that's how, you know, the the past generations have turned this land into viable farmland. But if you were to turn those pump stations off, that groundwater level would rise up and it would restore itself to Repo with very little effort. The difficulty in doing that is that a whole lot of people have bought farms and created these, you know, businesses that operate that rely on that low groundwater level, and you have to find a way of compensating them for the loss of that business opportunity in order to do that. And so that's the kind of thing that we're looking for, is to how can you find those opportunities to create wetland without sending everybody in the catchment out of business, say?
The council and Te Wahapu o Waihi, using funding they got from the Ministry of the Environment, have bought this patch of land. Later in the year, they'll start the process of returning some of it to wetland, creating habitat and tackling paru, or pollution.
Together, we'll retain ownership of the 30 hectares of land here and turn it into a combination of treatment wetland to remove some of that paru from the water, and natural coastal wetland, which is more for ecological, cultural and aesthetic values.
From our vantage point beside the Pongakawa River, the main river that flows into the estuary, Kura points inland into the distance, the vast area wetland once would have covered.
We were known as net makers, and this is where we would come to harvest harakeke, tikauka, etc. to make nets for fishing and other stuff. Or have you noticed, though, as you're walking around, as all the mahi you've been doing, that all the canals, that all the awa that feed into our estuary are straight? Where, eh? Because Papa Tuanuku, she don't go straight. She meanders. A wainui, they meander. So here, the Pongakawa, this river, goes straight. The Pokahina Canal that we drove alongside goes straight. That means that back in the day, they straightened all of our awa to make it easier for farmmen and those types of practices. And what that means then is that when all the paru from the land gets into the awa, it just goes whoosh, like a hydro slide, straight into the estuary, because there's no way for the paru from the land to kind of fall out of the water and settle on the sides. So that's a huge issue. So with this area here, what we want to do is, if you think of a wetland or a salt marsh even, there's a wetland just behind us that's been restored, it's like a sieve, or we would think of it as a korowai. It's like a sieve, and so when the water comes down to go into our estuary, it captures the wetland, captures some of that paru and sieves it through into the whenua. So when the water goes into the estuary, it's not as paru as when it hit the space.
This korowai Kura's talking about, the salt marsh, will also help to defend the coastline against the storm surges and flooding climate change is bringing. And it will almost certainly trap carbon too.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I mean, when Pim talks about compensating for the loss of a business opportunity, some New Zealanders are converting farmland to forestry to earn carbon credits. Could you get credits for converting to wetland when it makes sense for your land to do that instead?
Short answer is not quite yet in New Zealand. Here's Te Taru White again.
It's an infancy here in New Zealand. And overseas, we're attracting research interest. You know, I guess it's to try and expand that domain of data that says this is a viable solution. Plant more wetlands where it's appropriate for improving environmental gains.
Around the world, many countries are including coastal wetlands in their climate accounting and tying them to carbon credit schemes. The current government's coalition agreement between the National Party and New Zealand First Party says it will progress work to recognise other forms of carbon sequestration, including blue carbon. But right now, we don't have the kind of scaffolding you would need, sturdy science and well-established monitoring, reporting and verification schemes. The research interest Te Taru mentions is an international NGO called the Nature Conservancy. They're collecting a whole bunch of data before and after the restoration, which they'll use to investigate how viable a carbon credit scheme could be.
It's an opportunity, right? Yet to be realised, but we think it's a great opportunity. I mean, you know, if we make a start here and we've got wetlands around the country emerging, then cumulatively, that's got to be a benefit. Where people stop talking about the badness of exotic forests, you know, but it's the only option right now, to an option that has got a multiple of benefits.
For Te Wahapu o Waihi, it's a potential bonus, but not the core focus of their mahi.
One of our tohunga, one of our guides, a wisdom man, he gave us the vision. Hei oranga te wahapu, hei oranga te iwi. Let the health of our estuary be a metaphor for the health and well-being of our people. We have a common goal, and our common goal is to do the best to regain our mana, in this case, the mana of our water and our land, that honours our ancestors who have left it for us.
And part of that vision includes these rangatahi and their work. Here's Charles Butler.
We're all from the ages from 15 to 18. Me, myself, I'm 16. It'll look like a good opportunity, and to me it's all about, you know, the young rangatira standing up and doing it yourself for motuhake, so...
Yeah, what made it seem like a good opportunity to you?
Oh, just, you know, I love the nature, I love the ocean, I love everything about, you know, being outside, so I just thought, you know, there's not a better opportunity out there at the moment, so...
And what kind of stuff have you been doing?
But everything, really. I think the question should be, well, haven't we done?
He's not really exaggerating here. The group has been interning for the whole summer and they've been busy. Belang Afrika, Te Muira Tapso and Faith Eru fill me in on what they've been up to, monitoring and surveying beaches in Kai Moana, looking at water quality and invertebrates in the awa, and trapping predators, weaving both Western science and mātauranga Māori.
A lot of hands-on stuff, but I think something that's just important is learning about the history, about the whole place. You know, it makes it really special. The work that we do makes it more special, and it gives you motivation. So,
yeah, does it sort of change the place to you once you know all of these stories?
Yeah, it kind of gives it a makes
more
it more
meaning,
yeah,
deeper meaning.
Makes it heavier. Yeah, I don't know how to explain it.
Being able to make those connections with like your iwi, hapu, whakapapa, the whenua, and then learning all about like the tikanga as well. Yeah. Definitely makes it special.
Te Taru White is proud of their collective action and has high hopes for what comes next.
15, 20 years, I will see a major change. I will see that no longer a farm. I'll see that as a wetland. I'll see a mosaic of wetlands around the place that become part of the feature of our landscape. You know, we talk about New Zealand being New Zealand clean and green. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's the vision I would like to see. A New Zealand that's authentically clean and green. I can see these kids here, these students here, in 15 years' time being what kura is, being champions for this real estate, being able to extend that, what I would call aroha, to the land, to the people, and to show the way, and to embrace, you know, sometimes what can emerge as a very divisive society to one that's inclusive. And I think the next generations are the ones who can do that. It's this sort of thing that will bring them together.
Yeah.
Something they can do to be proud of the fact that they are looking after, you know, Mother Earth.
The blessing of the land took place last year. The cows are gone from the fields. And the nearby patch of already restored salt marsh also brings Professor Kura Paul Burke hope as to what the whole estuary might be in the future.
If you look at seagrass, mangroves, salt marsh and wetlands, what those plants do is they capture carbon. Oh look, going through, can you see them?
Can you
see the inanga?
Oh wait, they're just
there.
Going back out.
Just there. Oh yep, here, can you see them?
This is what you want, eh? Increased biodiversity, native species, plants, fish, inanga, doing what they're meant to do and to stay here.
How cool. But even if we do restore a ton of wetlands and protect the carbon sinks of Fiordland, it doesn't mean we can keep burning petrol, gas and coal.
Yeah, we have to stop doing that as well. Really, the increased carbon sucked up by a flourishing wetland would just return the situation to what it was before we ruined it. It can't really compensate for the fossil fuels we're still digging up and flooding the atmosphere with. That's a whole additional source of carbon. Fiordland seems to be a vital carbon sink for us. But that's not the only thing it does. It's also home to amazing plants and animals. And the idea with this Waihi project is that it too will be a win-win. For Kai Moana, for the wetlands, for the birds, for tangata whenua and everyone that lives around it. And for storing carbon. It's possible that that might translate into dollars on the international carbon market. But like they say, that's a bonus. It's still a good thing to do regardless. For so many reasons.
Are you having people waiting for the thing and then you're here?
that was science journalist Kate Evans, who researched and reported this story for New Zealand Geographic. She spoke to Dr. Rebecca McLeod, Associate Professor Chris Moy and Adele Heinemann, and to Professor Kuro Paul Burke, Titaru White, Pim Demonchi, and Charles Butler, Bella Nafika, Tamura Tapsil and Faith Eru. Voice of Tangaroa is a joint production between RNZ's Our Changing World and New Zealand Geographic. New Zealand Geographic reporting on the Voice of Tangaroa is public interest journalism funded through New Zealand On Air. You can learn more and read the articles for free at nzgo.com/seas. Kate Evans and Richard Robinson are the main journalist and photographer of the series. Additional reporting was by Bill Morris. This episode was produced by Kate Evans and me, Claire Kincannon, with help from Ellen Rikers and Brianna Juritich. Thanks to senior producer Phil Vine for editing help. Sound engineering was by William Saunders and Steve Burridge. Executive producers are Tim Watkin of RNZ and James Frankham of New Zealand Geographic. Original music for this series was created by the Wellington-based group Grains. You can find them on Spotify. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and family. Te nā koe I whakarongo mai. Thanks so much for listening. Ko Claire Kincannon aho, mā te wā.
Think we'll be on radio?
Maybe. I'll let you know if you are.
I'd like to shout out to all my friends back home.
Yeah.
Thanks for the whānau that got us here today.